All right. Well, welcome everyone. Nice to see you. We'll go around and say hello, starting with Bob, Kay, Paul, Mark, Susan, who looks like she's on the coast, Sam, also on the coast, Tyler, Jinryu, Jim, Marv, John, Gathel, Joan, Alice, Katie, Linda, Mick, Sabrina, Franklin, Drew, Karen, and Mac. The top of Marv's basket is getting smaller. Nice to see the progress. Let's see. All right. Saturday is a 1-day retreat. So if you're welcome to join us for part of the day or all of the day. If you can, it goes from it starts, you know, like just like you do with sitting ordinarily on Saturdays, 8:30. But then we go to a chanting service and a suggested silent mindful work period. And then we come back together for lunch. We have a formal meal verse, and then there's a little break, and then we come back together again. It's a very sweet way to bring retreat practice into your own home and daily life. Let's see. So the schedule is in the newsletter and on the website. And if you are going to be there all day, you know, it's kind of nice if you do register, just know that you're going to be there. But it's not necessary. You can just drop in as you feel like it. Precept study will begin, I believe, April 13th. So there's what does that mean? One more foundational teachings class? Yeah. So next week will be the last foundational teachings class, and then we'll be on to the precepts, our annual study of the precepts. And if you are thinking about receiving the precepts this year in our Jukai ceremony and formally becoming a Buddhist, then it's good to try to attend as many of those classes as you can. Although, you know, if you need to miss a couple, of course, they are recorded, thanks to Bob, and posted after a couple days. So you can always listen to them afterwards. There won't be any one particular text that we're using this time. Any of them are great. So the different seniors who are going to be teaching the classes will be drawing from different sources. My favorite personally is Waking Up to What You Do by Diane Rossetto, because it's just so, you know, how do you practice with this moment by moment every day? But the others are great too. So on the website where I have, there's a page about the precepts, and there's four different books about the precepts, and I have links to all of them so that you can check them out. Also keep your eye out for a special announcement. Hasn't gone out yet. If you are in the Portland area, there is an opportunity to support, I believe it's a Cambodian Buddhist temple, April, I think it's 14th through the 18th or something. It's like 4 days. And there's an effort. I mean, they started this and people are signing up to, that is their New Year's celebration. And as a largely Asian temple, they have been, individuals have been targets of bias crimes, and I guess somebody came by and like threw a potted plant through their window. And so they're nervous about being targeted. And so during their New Year's celebration, allies are signing up to go basically stand outside the entire time. So there in this email, there's a Google sheet where you can sign up and you can say that I'm available on these days and we're going to go, and they're going to give us t-shirts and we're going to stand outside. I mean, it's really heartbreaking that it is required, but it also, you know, is a very sweet way to be able to stand up and get to know these folks. I don't know anybody from this temple, but then now we will. So it's in West Lynn. So that's a suburb south of Portland, but not too terribly far. So that will go out, and I encourage people to, there's also a GoFundMe for that effort and related efforts to support Asian communities. So keep an eye out for that. And maybe you can get some other folks to sign up for the same times to go and support. Anything else anybody can think that needs to be announced, or any questions?
Domio, for the retreat on Saturday, we're skipping the check-in that we usually do. Does that just go away?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that'd be kind of sad, but yeah, day for being quiet together. But if you are there for the whole day, then we do a checkout at the end of the day. So that's kind of sweet. All right. So tonight is foundational teachings class about emptiness. Yay! So if you have been part of our chanting services on Sundays at all, or been studying Mahayana Buddhism or Zen much at all, you will have encountered the Heart Sutra, Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra, which is really the Mahaprajna Para, what is it called exactly? Anyway, Prajna Paramita is the perfection of wisdom. Prajna being wisdom, and a paramita being perfection. So it's the sutra, the Prajna Paramita Sutra. And it talks about how all dharmas, all things, are marked by, and the original term is shunyata. So it's translated often as emptiness, but it also can be boundlessness. And some of the phrases, so if you have the chant book, it's on page 22. And I don't know if, maybe Bob, if you could post a link either to the whole chant book or just to the Heart Sutra. I'm not sure we have it independently. Probably be. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. When deeply practicing Prajna Paramita, the perfection of wisdom, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. So the aggregates are form, sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. So these are the components of a human being. And she saw that they were empty. So empty. What is empty? Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. So emptiness is not something other than these manifestations. So all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. And as I talked about in my podcast episode, this is essentially saying the quality of emptiness, the quality that we're going to be talking about, trumps the three marks we talked about earlier, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. So the impermanence, the not self, ungraspable, and the dissatisfactory, like the, in the sense everything's empty, they're not even that. So this is quite a radical way to put it. It's basically, and then it goes on to list all these different Buddhist teachings, and it says, you know, none of them apply either, in a sense. So what is this about? It's very, it's a term you're going to hear a lot in Zen. And emptiness can sound kind of negative, and it can sound like we're saying things don't exist. I mean, that is kind of what the Partridge is saying, right? There is no this, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. And one of the Zen ancestors, when he was, the story goes, when he was a child, he heard this chant and he kind of went like, I have a nose and an ears and, you know, what are you talking about? Like, what is this, you know, what is this about? So we're meant to ask that question. So empty, if you think about it, it's like, what kind of things do we say are empty? We say like a glass is empty, a bowl is empty, a house is empty, that it's empty of something that it could contain, empty of something that we expect to be there. So the what this is about is everything, including ourselves, being empty of something very specific. That is an inherent, independent, enduring self nature. So a self essence that is inherent. It's not dependent upon other things. It functions independently. It may be, you know, affected by other things, but fundamentally there's some essence which is its own and enduring. So we, in some sense, we imagine that, you know, when we were a child, there was us. And then when we were a young adult, there was us. And, young, you know, it all along, it's been me in some essential way. So that is what we're saying. And then, of course, we figure that's what we care about the most, that we have that enduring, independent self nature. It's kind of just by nature, like that's what we care most about. But we also assume other people have that, and we assume pretty much everything has that, some kind of essence. And we're saying that essence is not actually there. That is something that we imagine. It's something that we impute. It's something we project onto things. And this is not about philosophical speculation, because, you know, what's the point? Everything in Buddhism has to tie back to, does it relieve suffering? Does it bring wisdom? Is it in accord with reality, and why does that matter? So it's not a philosophical speculation. It's an experience, an important experience. So as the Heart Sutra says, with nothing to attain, because even nirvana is empty, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita. And thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. So one of the things I want to do first is to go into breakout rooms and ask you to consider emptiness. What does it mean, and what is it good for? So trying to describe it in your own words, and maybe has this teaching, or or experience, perhaps small experience, large experience of emptiness been important in your practice? If so, how? And if the concept is just either new to you, or you just feel like, I just have no idea, then look at the Heart Sutra and come up with some questions. What is this? To just kind of explore it together. And because it's very central to our practice, but it's also something that perhaps we can easily dismiss as not being all that important, except to maybe just understand what the concept is in theory. But the idea is that exploring this and really personally waking up to what this is what really liberates. And we'll go into that more, but I just wanted to note before we do that because so far we've been talking about really traditional, what do I want to say? I mean, this is a traditional Buddhist teaching as well, but up till now, it was like we were studying the trunk of the Dharma tree, and now we've gone off onto a branch. So there is some reference to emptiness in the Pali Canon, is in some of the older teachings, but it's treated very differently. It's treated like a meditative tool, or that is the outcome of, you know, really focusing on not self. This is not self. And so I just wanted to read, you know, to give you a sense of how far we've departed. This is a Theravadan monk and scholar, Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he says, and he's a very like kind and ecumenical guy. I mean, he'll, you know, he goes to like, he hobnobs with Zen people and whatever, but he's just from a scholarly point of view, he's saying here, the Mahayana schools, despite their great differences, concur in upholding a thesis that from the Theravada point of view borders on the outrageous. This is the claim that there is no ultimate difference between samsara and nirvana, defilement and purity, ignorance and enlightenment. For the Mahayana, the enlightenment which the Buddhist path is designed to awaken consists precisely in the realization of this non-dualistic perspective. The teaching of the Buddha, as found in the Pali Canon, does not endorse a philosophy of non-dualism of any variety. Nor, I would add, can a non-dualistic perspective be found lying implicit within the Buddha's discourses. At the same time, however, I would not maintain that the Pali Suttas propose dualism, the positing of duality as a metaphysical hypothesis aimed at intellectual assent. I would characterize the Buddha's intent in the canon as primarily pragmatic rather than speculative. So basically, it's a very, very different approach. And earlier in this article, he says, essentially, and I'm totally paraphrasing here, but he essentially says, like, don't let yourself get too stuck in trying to like meld these things together and figure out how they fit together. It's like different practices and schools of thought have very different frameworks and approaches. And in a way, it's best to just like, you know, focus on the framework for your own practice and not worry too much about the fact that that other one seems to be saying something different. So anyway, all right. So breakouts for maybe 10, 15 minutes of emptiness. What does it mean and what is it good for? And I hope people will just be honest, like either if you do have some sense of what this is or what it means, that you go ahead and share that. But if you don't, you know, go ahead and say that, or say, you know, are there any teachings or explanations that have made sense to you, or any ways that have helped you understand this, or maybe just questions about why it is that we care about this, or anything in the Heart Sutra that you want to focus on questioning about. So I will. All right, you're welcome. All right. Do people mind reporting back a little bit about, I don't know, something cool you heard in terms of how emptiness was experienced or described and or questions?
Well, I know that I'm almost always the first one, but I think this is the perfect time for me to ask you a question that I have always meant to ask. And we talked about, I brought up the topic of a book right at the last minute. I'm going to put the name of the book in the chat. But who was the first English translator of any of this stuff? Or where did it come from? Because somebody chose the word emptiness, and why? Because, as I was saying in our little group, the Japanese say something entirely different. The Chinese say something different. In India, they say something different. I cannot believe that what they're saying is as disconcerting to them as the word emptiness is to us. And having said that, we talked about in our group the fact that Kaz Tanahashi thankfully began to translate the term emptiness as boundlessness. But as a Westerner, I mean, this is, I'm finally quite comfortable with it. But if we immediately switch the conversation and start talking about emptiness, I kind of go through a whole thing in my head. Oh, now I remember. This is what we're talking about. And so that's my question. Who came up with this?
I don't know. There were some really early translators, but I think people would have changed it if there was a wide enough consensus that there was a better translation. Because we've gone ahead and done that. You look at really old translations of Buddhist materials, and modern ones look quite different, but I don't really know. I mean, that would be fascinating to know. But what the different terms and translations have been, but I don't, I mean, I like the term boundlessness as well, and that gets to part of it. But there's something provocative about the term empty, and then it's supposed to be disconcerting. Because we're so attached to that idea that we have an inherent self nature, and we're saying, no, you don't. Like, so it's, I feel like boundless sounds like, oh, that's nice. We're one with everything. But it doesn't point to, like, and that means there's nothing in there. So I guess I don't, I think there's a utility to it being a kind of tricky word.
In Ryu, I looked up, just now you brought it up, so I had to look up the Chinese Heart Sutra, and I just read it. And the word empty is kong in Chinese, which it really does mean empty. It means hollow, empty. It's also a character for air.
Ooh.
So kong qi is like the air, meaning like transparent nothingness.
So they're saying empty too, really, is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, and I just, Kate looked up who the first English translation is of the Heart Sutra, and it is from Chinese. It's a translation of a Chinese script, not a Sanskrit.
And you learn that in Kaz Tanihashi's book, which I think is great. And but the reason the book I put in the chat came up is that And Alice, I'm sure you can add to this. This book is about how people from the East think, Asia, China, Japan, Korea, and how Westerners think. And it's really mind-blowing in terms of how different our approaches are. So that's what got me hung up on the word emptiness. And I think I'm taking us off course, so I'll mute myself now.
Oh, I think it's great. I like going off of the hollow thing from Alice, a lot of the analogies from the suttas, they're about for emptiness, they're images of hollowness, you know, like our skandhas are like sheaves of wheat leaning against each other to dry, not against a pole in the middle. So if you take one out, they all fall down because there's nothing in the middle, or like there's a ficus, some species of ficus tree that doesn't have a heartwood, and its trunk is just these intertwined fibers. And you could see, right, you know, you could see a squirrel run right through the bottom of it. So it really does mean, you know, you thought we have this sense that there's a nugget of me in there, but no. It does mean hollow, I think.
It looks like Bob and then Drew.
Okay. I beg to differ with John, because I'm reading this and I'm looking at other stuff, and I'm saying, you know, it's clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty. Okay, what are the five aggregates? And they talk about the physical world, sensation or feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, including all thoughts. But that doesn't mean self or spirit that essence that transcends all existence, that formulates or that inoculates itself into a new consciousness, that still is there, that essence is still there. This doesn't address that part. This addresses the fact that our physical world and everything we sense about it is just air, just an emptiness. I know, I'm not making myself clear, because this is
very new. I think so. And I think, you know, there are different spiritual paths for different reasons. And there are plenty of people who are Christian and Buddhist, or Jewish and Buddhist, and still retain a belief in God, which or some kind of soul or essence or something like that. I would find that tricky myself, because the basic statement is there's nothing besides the five aggregates. So the aggregates are a shorthand for everything that makes up our experience. So it's kind of like nothing, in theory, nothing is left out. So there is nothing else. There's your body, there's your form, your sensation, and whatever, and there's just nothing else. But the important thing, I think, is that does not mean existence is a nihilistic void. It means that the liveliness that we respond to, that animates, that caused cells to come together and crawl out of the ocean, is not, maybe it's better in this case to think of it as boundless, that we're not the little separate package that we think. We are dependently co-arisen with everything. So in a sense, that mystery of life is not ours. We don't have a little personal package of it. It's we participate in it in a larger sense. So even though nothing can be grasped, that doesn't mean there's nothing there, if you will. Difficult. Drew?
So what you were just describing, Domio, reminded me a bit of, I think it was Eckhart Tolle who said that you're just the universe expressing itself as a human being for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, people are used to thinking of the universe as like kind of being this big container in which we live, but really the universe by definition is everything. And so, you know, each of us is, the universe is in each of us, I'll put it that way. Jinryu, you mentioned that you like boundlessness better than emptiness. I prefer emptiness myself. I feel like boundlessness is implied by emptiness. So the way I think about it is, we have all these mental constructs, right? I mean, you know, when I think of a book, I think of something that has a hard cover, it has paper in it, it has little marks and words and so on and so forth. But while I'm looking in that book or thinking about that book, my mind is assigning all of these labels and trying to assemble all of this relevant information rather than simply just seeing that there is an object there that has its own quality to it. So that, like that notion of suchness, that like the only kind of real thing is suchness and everything else is empty. It's all mental constructs.
I like that analogy. Marv.
Well, we seem to have passed this, but I read somewhere that the word for zero in Sanskrit was shunya. Mm. And so it's derived from that. I haven't checked that out myself. Mm. That's what I read. So in that sense, emptiness is a good translation. But I agree that boundlessness, or I would call it boundaryless, is a very good interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Franklin.
Yeah, I I struggle with this notion, like a lot of people, I'm sure. Emptiness, and then I guess no self, you can lump in there as well. With some of the ideas that come out of evolutionary psychology and Robert Wright's excellent book, which I loved, it's called Why Buddhism is True. And and this notion that, you know, we certainly have a self from the point of view of evolution, and the desire to survive seems pretty strong for not only humans, but, you know, many species. And I think that our notions of emptiness are somewhat counter to these evolutionary drives, in the sense that, you know, categorization, compartmentalization, judgment, all these things are what help keep us alive as a species. And so I don't know how to reconcile those two concepts.
Well, that's what next week is about.
Okay.
I mean, so really, like, next week is like absolute and relative, right? Because then it's like, well, okay, so in a way, it's all just mental labels and there is nothing, and so, well, then, well, how do you live? And in a way, so the essence of it is like the enlightened being doesn't see those as different, like absolute and relative are two sides of the same coin. They appear to be very separate and sometimes contradictory aspects of reality, but they're actually just just two different sides. So that, but it's not that easy, right? Just because intellectually somebody says, oh, well, they're not really separate. Oh, okay. You know, because we have to live this. We have to, because the idea is that we, you know, this is supposed to make us beyond hindrance and fear, right? To really bring us to a sense of peace. So what, you know, why would emptiness of self in particular be a good thing? At first it just sounds kind of negative, right? Just sounds like, well, you know, almost everything that you experience, you know, which evolution has brought you to experience, is just BS, and there's really nothing there. It's a just a nihilistic void. Everything's meaningless. Nothing really exists. It's like, oh, but that is, if that is the way that emptiness appears or feels, or is the impression you get, that's not what is meant. So what is meant is a relief. We recognize, like, all of this, especially this sense of self, that I figure I am the protagonist of my life journey. I am the doer. I am the experiencer of pleasure, pain, happiness, or misery. I am the thinker, the feeler, the speaker, the decision maker, the performer. I understand or I don't understand. I achieve, I fail to achieve. I am happy, I am unhappy. I am loved, I am unloved. Like that sense of inherently existing self, we think is essential. But when we challenge that, and through meditation, because we really don't achieve this, very few of us can achieve this thinning of this delusion of self unless we practice meditation. But when that thins, we realize, like, you don't need that delusion. You don't need that narrative. You don't need to project a sense of continuous enduring self. You can function perfectly well. You can recognize what needs to be done. You can recognize hot and warm, and yeah, I should take care of this thing right now, without carrying around this sense, this extra sense of self. And when we get to be free of that, it's actually quite liberating. So I'll leave it at that for the second, and open it up to Peter.
It's my awareness that the people who live the longest generally eat the least. And so that doesn't mean that the following is true, but I'm going to just say words are expensive. The more I say right now, the more I put things, you know, I remove emptiness. It's as if, you know, we're foxes with our tail caught in a trap, and the more we talk, the more we tighten the trap. And so if I can stop struggling, if I can stop talking, I might not tighten the knot so much. That's how it's occurring to me. Just be still.
Well, maybe, but if you never encountered the teaching of emptiness and not self, you could be very still in the middle of your self delusion and never have it questioned. So it's like Buddhist teachings aren't meant to, like, give you more crap in your head. They're meant to challenge the crap that's already in your head. Katie.
Oh, when we were talking, I was thinking about intuition and how intuition kind of comes over you and it feels very personal. And it's so useful. So I was just wondering how that fits in with, I mean, I could see how you could still have intuition, but if you were empty. But you do have intuition. Everybody has intuition, and sometimes it's like saves your life. So I guess I was kind of thinking about that.
I would say intuition is you know, when we talked about what the universe, we're the universe manifesting as a human being, our experience of intuition is like this being taking care of itself or responding appropriately in a way that our little sense of executive eye doesn't feel like it's in charge of, right? It's like, oh, a lot of what we do. So in a way, I feel like this is like a when we experience intuition, that is an example. That's a proof of this emptiness, that like this little assumed self is not, that it didn't come from that self. it came from somewhere. So actually, today when we were reading the Guidepost for Silent Illumination, a couple of these lines came out to me on page 47. Responding without falling into achievement, speaking without involving listeners, the 10,000 forms majestically glisten and expound the Dharma. All objects certify it, everyone in dialogue. So it's like responding without, you know, some sense of like, I am going to do this thing and succeed or fail. Speaking without involving listeners, you know, that's a separation between I am speaking and you are listening. And yet the speaking can happen somehow. So there's a very natural, uninhibited kind of functioning that can happen when we are free of the sense of self. Mac?
Thank you, Domio. Yeah, I that was beautiful what you just said. And I think that where am I trying to find the difference between feeling the emptiness, practicing the emptiness, and executing what some living the practical matters of daily living, taking care of your business. You have to get up, you have to work, you have to do these things, but there's really no have to. So it's the difference with like coming from emptiness. There is no have to, there is no self, there's no ego. But on the other hand, some ego is required in order for you to go to your job and execute it properly. So that balance is very difficult to for someone new like myself in this practice.
Yeah, I mean, and like I said, that's what we'll talk about next week, which, you know, there's in Zen, we have a really beautiful way of picturing this that, and it's called the five Dharma positions or five ranks, where it's like, you know, at first we're just kind of in ignorance and there's just the relative. There's just this world that we, you know, perceive good, bad, self, other, this world of distinctions, which, you know, we function in. It's where we survive. And then we don't know anything. And then the second is where we perceive that there's something other, there's some other aspect of reality. So there are some other ways of perceiving and functioning, but we don't really know what they are. And then the third is insight into this aspect of reality where really there's only this moment. In this moment, you know, if we really settle into that and let go of our whole mental map of past and future and everywhere else, like in this moment, we don't have names. That's just a word that is used to refer to us. We don't have a name. We're not defined by our past. We don't know what's coming. Everything is just what it is. We can, you know, tell a story about it. We can categorize it, but ultimately in this moment, it's just what it is. And there's a certain just luminous and preciousness to it that we don't have to judge good and bad. But, right, if you just hung out there, you know, you'd lose all your relationships, you wouldn't pay your bill, you wouldn't function in the world. So people can get stuck there in spiritual practice. And a lot of teachings are about like nudging people out of that, like, oh, I see how everything's empty. And then there's a fourth Dharma position, which is basically like, so how do these work? How does this work? Because the nature of reality is like both of these things are together. Not emptiness is real, relative isn't. We have to wrestle with life and find out how this functions. How does this work? What does this matter? How do I bring that insight of emptiness into my activity? And that's where like most of our work happens, is in this integration, in this learning to live with this. And then there's a fifth Dharma position, which is like kind of just like, it's returning to the marketplace, it's naturalness. It's like, I'm not like, oh my God, what about absolute and relative? How does this all work? Am I doing it now? It's just, you know, it becomes something so integrated and natural that we're just like a normal person again, not so wrapped up in it. So there's that whole, this whole fascinating teachings around how we embrace this teaching and why is it useful and how do we explore it and actually apply it in our lives. So that'll be next week. So thank you all for being here. Close with a verse. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Have a good evening.
Thanks, friends.
Thank you, Damian.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you. Konbanwa.
Damio, did you have a good weekend?
Oh yeah, I forgot. I was going to put a link to an article about our action in the chat. There you go. Now you know how my weekend went.
Thank you.
Sure.
So that you were right about worrying about violence. There was violence the next day. Did you read about that? Someone pulled a gun?
Yeah. You know, these Proud Boys are like, I mean, they're not always harmless, but a lot of times I think they're just like, they're these guys, white guys, pumped full of testosterone in big pickup trucks, driving around with guns because they can. They just, it's like major posturing. It's just like, and sometimes I wonder like if the best thing to do is just to ignore them, honestly, but they don't like then the Antifa, like, oh my God, the Proud Boys are going to come. So then down in Salem, it was probably like, you know, maybe a dozen Proud Boys and 150 Antifa. So like the Antifa response is just like, that's, so anyway, we heard tell there might be an Antifa Proud Boy thing conflict with our action as an excuse, but I don't know that it really would have happened, but we'll be better prepared next time. And we won't be downtown and we won't plan to go into the evening. Which means we have to make whatever we do more disruptive so the cops don't let us go into the evening. Okay. You're back, Peter.
Did you post something on the chat? And I just didn't understand what you were saying.
Yes, I did.
I failed to get it. So please post it again. Thank you. Yeah, I just, I got intimidated and I went away. Thank you.
Oh, glad we were still here. You got it now?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much.
Sure. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.